introduction to the mediation process, which will include our watching a mediation on video in a few minutes. We will, in subsequent weeks, begin to make the transition from, remember, we started with some brief overview of negotiation paradigms. Now we're going to be talking about the mediation process, the role of the mediator, the special kinds of characteristics one would want to look for in an effective mediator, and then move into some of the special things that distinguish clinical healthcare mediation from mediation in other settings. So let's just begin, before we look at the video, with some... can everybody see? Do you have enough? Everybody good?
Yep.
With some very general notions about what mediation is. And if you look at the first slide, you will see that basically mediation A is a form of assisted negotiation, which I have previously mentioned. And it utilizes, as a neutral, the mediator. The process, as we've discussed when we talked about collaboration in the Barbara Gray sense of the term, of consensual resolutions, is implicitly true of mediation, because if you think about it, mediation cannot come to fruition and be successful without all of the parties agreeing to the resolution that they themselves have created. That is the very nature of mediation. In other words, we are not, as mediators, dictating outcomes to third parties. This is somewhat antithetical to the manner of resolving disputes by either adjudication or arbitration. In other words, let's think about a courtroom. Essentially, when you are involved in an adjudication, all of the balls and strikes that are being called by one of two kinds of parties, judges or jurors. Now, the judge, in a trial in which there is no jury, or what we call a bench trial, is in fact making both the findings of fact in connection with the dispute that's before him or her, but also applying the law to the facts and reaching the relevant legal conclusions that result in the outcome of the trial. If we are before an arbitrator as opposed to a mediator, we're still essentially dealing with the disputes via an adjudicatory model, even though it's not an adjudication in the sense of a formal adjudication by a court, but that arbitrator is still making the decision, imposing the outcome on the parties. It's a very important distinction, and as you can imagine, the fact that you as mediators, or we as mediators, are not doing that places us in a very different role vis-a-vis the parties than those individuals or groups who are in fact imposing rulings and judgments and verdicts on parties. Because in effect, we are non-coercive dispute resolvers, in the sense that we are not a third party imposing an outcome on disputants. Now, you can see as well from this slide that I'm referencing the informality of the process. Let's think about that for a minute too. You walk into a court of law. What do you see? A judge sitting in an elevated posture in relation to all of the other people in the courtroom, sitting in a black robe and wielding a gavel. You will not be sitting in a black robe. You will not be wielding a gavel. You will, in fact, not be calling any balls and strikes. What do I mean by calling balls and strikes? It's a great phrase, but I should be much more specific. We are not, as mediators, bound by the rules of evidence or procedures that courts, and to a somewhat lesser extent, arbitrators are bound by. Mediation, from the standpoint of the evidence, if we even want to call it that, the utterances that are made by the parties, or even documents that they may introduce into the mediation, are not limited and constrained, governed by a book of black letter rules that say, yes, this is admissible, no, this is inadmissible. First of all, when we talk, by the way, about admissibility in court of law, which is a term that pertains to evidentiary matters, what we're really saying is, you know, we're going to balance the potential probative value of this evidence, meaning its value in proving the truth of a particular matter, against the prejudicial potential of that same material for having an impact on the trier of fact that would be disproportionately inflammatory. Ergo, if I am in a criminal trial and I am the prosecutor and I want to convince the jury that Mesa is guilty, and I try to do that by introducing the fact that, oh, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, she did it four times before. Now, you can't do that because to try to convey to the trier of fact that she's guilty here because she was previously guilty, subject to certain exceptions, and we're not going to do an evidence class here, but subject to certain exceptions in which you can bring forward this evidence, by and large, you can't do something like that because, again, it will be, have a tendency to be overly prejudicial, okay? In mediation, you're the mediator, you are managing a process, and at the end of the day, although you do care about both the civility and the quality of that process, you are not going to constrain the parties from bringing into the process what they think is relevant. Wholly different standard as to admissibility and relevancy. If they think it's relevant, if they think it should be admissible, then fine. And why is that fine, and why is that okay? Just imagine the number of times in which legal disputes that appear on the face of them to be about X, you breached the contract with me, I want damages, or at the end of the day, things that arise not out of what it says in the complaint and the answer in the court of law, but the fact that I'm remembering that you once used to throw spitballs at my sister in class in sixth grade, and I've been looking, goddammit, for an opportunity to get back at you, and now I gotcha. You can't testify to that effect in a court of law, because it would be deemed irrelevant, okay? But for our purposes, it's quite relevant, because it may reveal things to us that give us a special opportunity to find ways in which to deal with this dispute creatively and constructively that are not open to courts of law. Meaning, courts of law have specified remedies that they can apply in different kinds of cases, most frequently for the remedy of money damages, at times injunctive relief to compel a party to do or not do something. But with rare exceptions, courts cannot sort of forge unique remedies without the consent of the parties that say, well, we're gonna make up our way of resolving this dispute. We're gonna say, let's, instead of saying there's a winner and a loser, let's figure out a better way. Judges can't do that. We can do that. Now, the reason we can do it is because we're not calling balls and strikes. Just think about it. If we were calling balls and strikes, meaning making factual or legal conclusions and applying them, it would appear that when we speak with an individual disputant, that we, speaking of prejudice, would be in a position where at least the party to whom we were not speaking would think, might think, that we were not neutral and not impartial. And even though, in fact, as is the case with judges, they may have, they're human beings, they're individuals, they have feelings, they have predilections, and they can set aside, in many cases, their personal preferences, their personal biases. But at the end of the day, what is germane is the appearance of partiality. And the appearance of partiality would certainly exist if I were listening to John when Mary was on the other end of the table and speaking to her in a caucus, which we are all not only allowed to do, but which we do frequently, on what in the law is called an ex parte conference, meaning alone with that party. We can do that because there is no fear that we are then going to render a judgment that is prejudicial or negative to one party, and it's the party with whom we've been conferring on an ad hoc ex parte basis, okay? So in other words, these two things fit together. The fact that any matters that the party wants to bring to your attention as relevant to a resolution of the dispute, and the fact that you can hear these things ex parte without being compromised is all a function of the fact that, as we indicated a few minutes earlier, that we are not bound by the rules of evidence and we're not bound by the rules of procedure. Okay? Now, I also addressed, when I talked about my sister in sixth grade having spitballs thrown at her, the fact that we're not limiting the parties to raising issues that are raised in the current dispute. And all of these things taken together create a circumstance or set of circumstances in which the likelihood of the disputing parties achieving catharsis, right, achieving catharsis as part of the dispute resolution process is enhanced and maximized, particularly in relationship to an adjudication on the merits in the context of an adversarial system in which at the end of the day, in most cases, there is a winner and a loser. And I am fond of saying that in the 40 years that I've been in and out of courtrooms, I'll tell you, I've never seen a party who lost the case walk out of the courtroom and say, oh, now I understand. I was wrong. It doesn't happen, guys. It simply doesn't. Come to the next slide. Now, mediation focuses on addressing the underlying interest of the parties, and we addressed what that means when we talked about the paradigm of integrative negotiation or interest-based negotiation. And as mediators, you will be functioning very much in the role of somebody who is catalyzing and helping the parties in trying to address many of the elements of the integrative negotiation process or interest-based negotiation process that we learned about, because you're trying to find out what their interests are so that we might be able to uncover, as we've already discussed, the possibility of a mutually beneficial or acceptable resolution. Meaning, if and when we ascertain that the interests of the parties, while they appear from their stated positions to be in conflict, are actually revealed to be either compatible or identical, we have the seeds of a resolution of their dispute. But it is they who are revealing to us, as a function of their own communication and with the assistance of the mediator as the manager of the process, what those underlying interests are. You will remember from our discussion of integrative bargaining that that is where the inevitable why question comes into play. Positions, issues, interests. Position, I want X. Why do you want it? Now I know. Remember the orange. Remember the Sinai Peninsula. And that is, in effect, the model that we're talking about. Now, there is another benefit to the mediation model of dispute resolution that is distinct from the adjudicatory model, which is that, if you think about it, since we are trying to forge, or help the parties forge, mutually acceptable consensual resolutions, I think you can see that it logically flows from that, that when you're successful, you have a greater possibility of preserving an existing relationship between these parties. Again, when the parties walk out of a courtroom after an adjudication on the merits, it is fairly rare for them to be either convivial or interested in forging ahead with and building on a previous relationship, because the very notion of having an adjudication on the merits tends to be an alienating force in driving the parties even further apart. And yet here, what we can find, and we know this statistically, I'm not just surmising this, we know statistically that there are many more situations where the parties, after a process like mediation, can find a way to move forward in their relationships. And in fact, sometimes the outcomes themselves, again, which can be unique and consist of a great deal more than money damages or injunctions, can include elements of a relationship going forward right within the resolution of the dispute itself. And you're going to see an example of that in a few minutes on the mediation I'm going to show you, the business mediation that I'm going to show you. And even when the relationship has to, in the party's view, terminate because of all that has passed between them, very often the nature of the breakup of the parties or of the non-continuation of the relationship may still come with an amelioration of the abrasiveness and anger that was previously there at the outset of the dispute, again in part because of the cathartic value of the mediation process, in which they get to tell their story. Very critical. Another enormous distinction between adjudication and mediation. You have all seen movies and television programs about trials. Some of you think Amy has probably been to them as well. Maybe not, but what happens? The trial begins. The first witness takes the stand. The attorney who is about to examine the witness begins to articulate her first question. The question isn't even completed. Objection. Objection. State your basis for the objection. The objection is made. Sidebar discussion: is it admissible? Is it relevant? Blah 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 blah. But guess what? The party, the disputant, isn't privy to that dialogue. And that party has now either, if they're the witness or if they're sitting there listening to the witness, has probably had about 4 seconds of substantive introduction to the material. And so, lo and behold, when we go and interview people after trials to try to find out their level of satisfaction with adjudication as a form of dispute resolution, they have a very low opinion of the impact of the process on them. And when we ask them why, strangely enough, they almost always say the same thing. Never got to tell my story. Well, how the hell do you get to tell your story when people are objecting every 10 seconds? So, you know, I'm being a little bit light in bantering about this, but it's very serious. Very serious, a very serious problem in looking at the actual impact on litigants of the formal system, which is our predominant method of dispute resolution in this country. So, next element of distinction. We talked about the judge and the jury as the third party imposing decisions, judgments, verdicts, rulings. But you see, here as mediators, you're not creating the resolution. You're not imposing an outcome on these disputants. They are creating their resolution to the dispute. And lo and behold, if it is an effective mediation, and you are an effective mediator, and you reach a resolution that they can consensually buy into, surprise, surprise, there is a higher likelihood of compliance and durability. Meaning, people are more likely to not comply with a resolution imposed on them by a third-party outsider. But if it's their resolution, they're not as likely to be non-compliant or subsequently take issue with that determination, which is their determination, but guess what? There's also nothing to appeal from. And in our legal system and our system of adjudication, probably most of you know that parties to a dispute in a civil matter, any jurisdiction, ordinarily have the right to at least one appeal of the trial below. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win it, but it certainly means that the finality that attached to the resolution in the court below is now subject to what is really, at the very least, a deferment of that finality. There's nothing to appeal from if it's your decision. What are you going to say? I'm going to appeal. This is the decision. I made it, but I don't like it. All right? So barring problems such as a total misunderstanding, and this will not happen when effective mediators are involved, a total misunderstanding of the consensual resolution, that it can be later proved the parties never had a meeting of the minds with respect to. In almost all successfully mediated cases, there is, in fact, finality. I think I have one more slide, Katrina, before we go to the videotape. Now, I want you, though, to understand as mediators that as managers of this process, while in fact you will be in a position where you will give a great deal of latitude, I am sure, to the parties who are before you, in permitting behavior that reflects the intensity of the thoughts and feelings they bring to the process. Because you, I'm sure, won't be surprised to know, whether it's in a clinical setting or a legal setting, or a business setting, disputes are often very emotionally charged. And that's one of the things you've got to deal with as a mediator. You're not going to be an effective mediator if you blanch and pass out when they start to hurl invectives at one another, or seem to be at a point where if you let it go much further, they might actually do violence to one another. Now, are you going to permit violence? Certainly not. One of the things that you are charged with educating the parties about is the fact that the dispute resolution process, be it mediation, arbitration, or adjudication, are all calculated to be alternatives to self-help and to violence. So just because this is a non-coercive process, it doesn't mean that it's a total free-for-all. And yet, having said that, I urge you to be mindful of this quote from Bernie Mayer in a book that he wrote called Beyond Neutrality. From a psychological and sociological perspective, mediation should not be synonymous with the suppression of conflict, emotion, and advocacy, all of which have important societal roles. And what that really means at the end of the day is if you bleed the process of the emotional undercurrents, all of the benefits that I've just conveyed to you that stem from the uninterrupted ability to tell one story, the notion that there is cathartic value in being able to do that in a relatively unimpeded way, all of those kinds of things go out the window if the process just becomes some kind of formalistic lip service to the notion that you really want to know why they're there. You do want to know, and they may be pissed. And you know what? Let them be pissed. Up to a certain reasonable point at which you believe that the process may be spinning out of control, in which case it's very much part of your role as the process manager to find a way to bring it back to where it's both manageable and productive. Now that can be, we'll get into how you do that. That can be done in many ways. Now, you know, of course, you can call time out. You can break into a caucus. And you can talk to each separately about what it is that they might feel would be a requisite from a decorum standpoint and a behavioral standpoint to having a productive process going forward. Usually very intense emotional situations can be dealt with by giving parties a cooling off period. And when people go to the extreme, which they do, by the way, with some frequency, of literally walking out and slamming the door, they'll come back. You know? And your faith in the fact that they'll come back is a very important thing. Because as the mediator managing the process, that faith that you have in that process that you're managing is conveyable to them, and it means something to them. Now, does that mean that every case will resolve in mediation? Absolutely not. Does that mean that every case should resolve? No, absolutely not. And we will talk a little later after the film about indeed what your responsibilities are in that regard. So I want to now put on what is in fact the film of a real mediation, but it is a reenactment in which the lawyers and clients are the actual lawyers and clients. But this is being filmed with the knowledge of everybody that it's kind of a reiteration. And I think you'll find this a wonderful learning experience. And it is a business mediation, and the subject matter will speak for itself. It's a little boring in the very beginning when they sort of try to describe how the dispute has arisen. But once you get past that initial statements
the initial statements of the facts, I think it's a wonderful illustration of how and why mediation can be so effective. So if you can, Katrina, I know we're experimenting a little bit. But
you probably have to. Yep. Good job.
Thank you very much.
How are we on volume?
Why does mediation capture the imagination of lawyers and managers who face disputes? Dissatisfaction with traditional resolution routes is part of the answer. Litigation is costly, prolonged, and produces a win-lose decision. Arbitration also results in a win-lose decision and is final and binding. In contrast, mediation is a rapid, low-cost process. Parties, not a judge, decide the outcome. The process is without risk. If the parties cannot agree on a mutually satisfactory outcome, they can resort to court. As I witness the critical segments of a mediation, describe for yourself why mediation has proven so valuable in commercial disputes. The case we're about to see promised to be a litigator's field day with contract and fraud claims, international parties, and prolonged discovery. A South American distributor of office equipment sued a United States computer manufacturer for $10 million for wrongful termination of a distribution contract. After filing the case in a California court, the parties agreed to mediate. They're employing the Centers for Public Resources commercial mediation rules, and they've selected a CPR neutral panelist as their mediator.
Good morning. I am Steve Goldberg, mediator you selected, and you are
Irene Morshauer, Anderson Kill, counsel for High Tech.
Steve, I'm Bob Walker, senior vice president for international business development at High Tech.
I'm Richard Chernick, I represent Prosondo.
And I'm Edward Meissner, Buenos Aires, and I'm the president of Prosondo.
Thank you very much. Before we begin, just a word about the mediation process. I am not an arbitrator, I'm not a judge, not going to issue a decision in this matter. Rather, my role today is to help you to work out your own resolution for your own problem. The way we will proceed, we will start in this joint session. I will ask each side to present its perspective on this matter. I will encourage participation by the business people whose dispute it is. After the joint session, we will move into private session or caucus. In these private sessions, I will ask you to be open with me, to tell me anything that you think might help me resolve this matter. Even if you don't want it repeated to the other side, and be assured I will respect that confidentiality.
After discussing the party's signed confidentiality agreements and statutory protections, the mediator asked Prosondo for its perspective on the dispute. Mr. Chernick stated that Prosondo is a German-Argentine joint venture specializing in sales of office equipment. In January 1990, Prosondo entered into a five-year contract for exclusive distribution of high-tech computers throughout South America.
The exclusive aspect of the contract was crucial. We spend a great deal of money at the beginning of the term developing the distributor network and expect to find our profits at the end of that term. We spent 2.5 years committing our resources and gearing up to perform this agreement when High Tech suddenly pulled the rug out from under us, terminating the entire contract on 30 days' notice in June of 1992. Under the express terms of the contract, High Tech had no right to terminate the agreement as it did. Not only did they terminate the contract, they interfered with our ability to perform the contract during the 2 years that we were establishing our distributor network. And if I can show you, I have a chart here. January of 1990 was the date of the contract. For 6 months following that date, we got no product. High Tech insisted that they wanted to renegotiate to give them the right to distribute along with us in our exclusive territory. It was not until June of 1990 that we were able to get our first product. And then, 6 months later, in January of 1991, we find that the product that we've been distributing has been canceled. A new product is being offered, but they won't give it to us under the contract. They claim that we're not entitled to distribute it. It took us 6 more months until June of 1991 to resolve that dispute. They finally gave us the right at that time to distribute the Century, which was a substitute product. And we only had 1 year until June of 1992 to develop our network before the termination occurred.
As a consequence of Hitech's actions, Presondo claims, first, that Hitech breached the contract by significantly interfering with Presondo's performance and by wrongfully terminating the contract. Second, that Hitech defrauded Presondo by knowingly entering into an agreement to sell a product when Hitech knew it was about to be canceled.
Presondo has suffered $10 million of damages, $3 million for compensatory damages, the losses incurred in developing the exclusive distribution network, $6 million in lost profits, and $1 million for loss of business reputation arising from the breach of contract and fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Wuchshauer, from the Hitech perspective.
In January 1990, Hitech entered into a distribution contract with Presondo. Presondo was appointed the sole distributor in South America for one line of Hitech's products, the Futura A and B mini computers. Presondo completely failed to implement this contract. They failed to abide by the order terms in the contract, which required an immediate order for 100 units or $1 million. And they failed to negotiate annual minimum purchase orders for each calendar year. First of all, the initial order was only for 50 units, not the required 100. Total orders, in fact, after 2.5 years of this contract, were only for 88 units. No negotiation or even discussion of annual requirements was ever initiated by Presondo, and they couldn't meet the agreed-upon payment terms. They owe us $126,000 now for the equipment shipped. Presondo totally frustrated the basic goal of the contract, which was to establish distributorships throughout South America. They held themselves out as experienced distributors of complex business products. However, we later learned that they had to develop a computer staff. Today, over 2.5 years into the contract, they have only 4 distributors, and all of those are in Chile.
Ms. Wuchshauer pointed out her client's good faith in patiently awaiting reorders. Hitech even provided the Century series, when the contract expressly limited Presondo's distribution rights to the Futura series. Termination was required, she claimed, but Presondo's failure to enter reorders pay for shipments, and most significantly, establish distributors. She then summarized her key contractual arguments.
An express term in the contract allows termination for failure to negotiate minimum purchase orders annually. We also rely on implied termination rights arising from the total frustration of this contract. We are astounded at this claim for lost profits, since the contract specifically excludes lost profits arising from termination. We're here to collect $126,000 and to terminate this relationship.
Thank you, Ms. Wuchshauer. Mr. Turner, Hitech tells me that they had an explicit contract right to terminate for failure to negotiate minimum annual purchasing requirements. I understood you to say that Hitech had no basis for terminating the contract. Could you explain?
Yes.
Presondo's response. Yes, the contract required yearly reorders, but the parties had agreed that such a requirement would apply only after Presondo completed a full year of selling Hitech computers. Since that year had just been completed at the time of termination, Presondo did not breach the reorder requirement. What's more, Hitech waived any reorder requirements by not raising the subject sooner. Hitech's response? Reorders were required 1 year from the date the contract was signed. Further, Hitech's patience in waiting for Presondo to place orders did not constitute a waiver.
Mr. Meisner, what do you have to add?
Mr. Goldberg, let me explain why Presondo is so upset about this whole matter. We negotiated the initial contract in good faith for the Futura model. Then, all of a sudden, Hitech comes out with this new machine called the Century. They must have known that they were developing a new machine. Mr. Walker knows that you don't develop a computer overnight. Then, to make matters worse, they interpret the contract so that we don't have the distribution rights for this new machine, the Century. We interpret this to mean that they wanted to to dump these models in Latin America, that we were victims of a scheme to dump these models, and in fact, we think we were defrauded.
No, sir. If I hear one more assertion of fraud, we're going to be out of these proceedings. These are the people that are represented to us that they were a supplier of office equipment, that they had trained people in place, yet in 2.5 years, they've only got 4 distribution systems in place.
Okay.
I want you to get our $126,000 for us, and then we'll be through with this proceeding.
Okay, I understand that there is some emotion here. That's normal. This is a significant matter for both. I think that this is a good time for us to move into our private session.
The initial joint session has multiple goals. Attorneys try to impress the mediator and opposing executives with the strength of their legal claims. Business clients are invited to share perceptions of central facts and can express pent-up anger. The mediator controls the questioning, assesses reactions, and seeks settlement clues. By giving equal attention to both parties, the mediator demonstrates his impartiality and commitment to assist them. When the joint session is no longer productive, the mediator moves into private caucus. At the beginning of the first caucus with each party, the mediator typically reconfirms confidentiality protections. As we join Crisando, the mediator is seeking information to understand the case better.
Rich, what do I need to know to really understand this matter?
Well, I'd like to emphasize that we had a detailed written contract that had very specific termination provisions. The implied termination right that HITECH claims is simply contrary to those provisions in the contract. In addition, HITECH's conduct interfered with our ability to establish our distributorship network and disabled us from being able to perform the provisions contained in the contract.
Okay. I understand, I think, the legal background, the legal issue. Ed, I'd like a better feel from you for the business background. What did you hope to get out of this deal?
Well, we thought we were entering into a partnership-type arrangement with HITECH, whereby we would be working closely together to mutually develop a market for the machine called the Futura in Latin America. Quite frankly, we thought the machine was an excellent machine. The price was good, the quality was good, and it fit very well into our other business line. We were willing to make the initial investment, but of course it was important to us that there was potential for future profit.
Ed, why are you here today? What is your goal in this mediation?
Well, let me assure you that we are here to settle this matter. We're not in the business of litigation. But time is of the essence. If we cannot settle this promptly, we're going to have to turn it over to the lawyers and litigate to the filth.
Why is time so important?
It's very simple. In reliance on the contract with HITECH, we have a large capital commitment, which we're paying interest on. We develop a sales staff and a support staff. We're having trouble keeping these people together, and there's a limited amount of time we can keep this staff together.
Okay, so you would like to continue in computer systems?
Oh, absolutely.
In the caucus, the mediator often seeks to shift focus away from legal positions to the party's interests and business goals. Here, the mediator involves the client by asking a series of questions in a form that encourages the client to discuss his concerns. The responses provide a sense of the client's priorities and potential settlement routes.
Have you given any thought to reconstructing this deal with HITECH so you can distribute HITECH computers?
You know, we're concerned about that because HITECH has been a very risky partner for us thus far.
Well, what will it take to settle this matter?
Well, we've asked for $10 million in the litigation, and that's our demand today.
Mediators often serve as agents of reality, as we'll see in the next segment. They ask parties to reconsider their claims in view of such objective criteria as contract terms, principles, or a court's likely reaction. By gentle, non-hostile questioning, the mediator encourages parties to consider potential weaknesses in their case, modify damage claims, and consider settlement possibilities.
Let's talk a moment about your lost profits claim, which I understand to be for $6 million. Ed, what sales projections are you using in calculating those figures?
Well, let me assure you, we've made extensive projections, and we think they're accurate, perhaps conservative. We project sales of about 150 units per year. That will be our existing distributorship and some developed distributorship.
How many distributors does that assume to get to 150 units a year?
Well, we think it will result in our needing about 7 or 8 more distributorships.
Any progress in that respect?
Yes. I will tell you that we have pretty firm commitments for 7 to 8 additional distributors, but we don't want this information revealed to Hi-Tech for competitive reasons.
Okay. Now, this is a claim for lost profits. What Hi-Tech told me was that the contract bars claims for lost profits. Now, how do you think the court's going to respond to that?
Well, Hi-Tech has to prove a proper termination in order to be entitled to the limitation. And since they terminated improperly, we don't believe that the exclusion is going to apply at all.
Okay, but that is going beyond the express terms of the contract and implying the requirement that termination must be proper.
Yes.
What's the likelihood that a court's going to do that?
Well, there's always some risk in interpretation.
There is? Well, can you put a value on avoiding that risk and give me an offer that might get Hi-Tech to move?
In response, Masada reduced its demand to $9 million. We joined Hi-Tech in the midst of the next caucus.
Very realistic.
Horshauer just restated her legal argument.
I understand your legal argument. What I'd like a better feel for, Bob, from you, is a business background. What did you hope to accomplish in entering into this deal originally?
Well, we saw at the time, and really we still see today, a significant market for our North American products into South America. And we thought Versando would be a company that could help us penetrate that market. But obviously, we were wrong on that score.
What are your present plans for penetrating the South American market?
Well, we're looking at other potential distributors. We have come to the conclusion that we're not going to be able to sell in that market without an on-site sales staff.
Tell me what you mean.
Well, you remember I told you about that 6-month hassle we had over whether we were going to have the right to distribute products in South America as well as Brazil. Well, I'm a little embarrassed, but that really turned out to be meaningless.
This absolutely has to remain confidential. It's embarrassing to us, and we just can't have Versando know about it.
Okay, but you do need a South American distributors. Have you given any thought to restructuring your deal with Versando so that it might work?
I've advised my client that his best interest lies in completely terminating any relationship with Versando. Hi-Tech's reluctance to consider future business dealings with Versando caused the mediator to ask for Hi-Tech's settlement proposal. Hi-Tech offered $250,000. This amount would compensate Versando for sales that lost when Hi-Tech gave only 30 days notice of termination instead of the 90 days required by the contract. Following the mediator's reality testing, Hi-Tech acknowledged some weakness from canceling the Futura A and raised its offer to $400,000.
Hi-Tech has offered $400,000 to resolve
this. You know, they really don't understand. It was their conduct which prevented us from achieving our sales during the first 2.5 years and deprived us of the last 2.5 years to achieve our real expected profits.
When you say it was their conduct, what about their claim that you always had Futura B to sell?
Oh, wait a minute, let me answer that. Futura B was available, but Hi-Tech knew from the very beginning that we were not going to market Futura B. Because it had features that didn't fit on market, it was more expensive, and it was a machine that we just wouldn't be marketing in South America. We did want to market the Century model.
Okay, but there is some risk that a court might say that the decision not to sell Futura B was yours.
Acknowledging some risk on the score, Versando further reduced its demand to $8 million.
Versando has come down to $8 million.
This is getting us nowhere. They don't have a chance of recovering those damages. The contract specifically excludes lost profits, and even if the court were to give them something, it'd be limited to this additional 60 days of lost sales minus mitigation.
Very well, I understand your position.
Mediation often begins with the parties exchanging legal arguments, insisting they'll prevail in litigation and making little progress toward settlement. At this point, the mediator may focus on the cost of litigation in the event parties don't settle. Those costs may encourage parties to put their legal arguments aside, at least temporarily, and search for a mutually acceptable resolution.
if you do go to court, what have you talked about in terms of the likely costs of litigation?
I understand from Mr. Chernick that if we do go to trial, there'll be about 8 months of discovery, probably a trial of about 3 weeks, and it's going to cost us, I assume, at least $500,000.
And how long before you get to trial?
2.5 years, perhaps 3.
And if you lost the trial, would you think about an appeal?
Yes, certainly. We haven't reached that decision yet.
And after you had done all that, could you guarantee to Ed that you'd win this case?
Of course not, but I do think our position is quite strong.
Well, the problem is that that is exactly what Hi-Tech thinks. So if we're going to make any progress in this matter, what I'm going to have to ask you to do, and I will ask them the same thing, is to let's put aside the questions of right and wrong for a little bit and see if we can work on some kind of settlement that you could live with, that they could live with, and that probably would not involve them paying you $8 million. Now let's just try, okay?
All right, well, actually we've been discussing this and mulling over. As far as Hi-Tech knows, we only have 4 distributors in Chile. In fact, we have 7 distributors in Argentina, which are pretty firm, and 2 real possibilities in Brazil. Now, I tell you this in confidence because we don't want Hi-Tech to know this and pirate our distributors. In fact, we also don't want them to know that these are all the distributors we have lined up in South America. But if we can get a firm deal for the Century Series, an exclusive distributorship in Argentina and Brazil and Chile, I think we can make a deal. But we don't want this offer coming from us. We want the offer coming from you, and if it comes back, I assure you we'll agree to it.
Mediators can facilitate this by proposing options as their own when parties refuse to put a workable idea on the table for fear of appearing weak.
If we were to structure such a deal, what would that do to your demand for $8 million?
Well, I think we could probably
Let's explore that. If you resumed operations, you'd have the 4 distributors you had in Chile, plus 7 in Argentina.
7 or 8.
Okay, and a couple in Brazil. So we're talking 11, 12, 13 distributorships. Now, I think you told me previously that selling 150 units a year would give you the profits you'd anticipate. All right? Okay. Now, if you had something in the area of 12 or 13 distributors, don't you think you could sell 150 a year and make the lost profits that you were talking about?
Yeah, I see your logic. If we could get a deal like that, I would recommend to my client that we limit our damages to $3 million.
In meeting with Hi-Tech, the mediator also began by focusing on the costs, delays, and uncertainties of litigation.
In light of all that, time, cost, etc., court, I'd like to try out perhaps an idea with you, a little bit different from anything we've talked about so far. Now, Bob, you said earlier that you were studying alternative distributorship possibilities in South America. What have you learned?
Well, yes, we have made some studies. Uh-huh. What we've learned is that no single supplier of office equipment can penetrate the entire South American continent. In fact, our studies show more specifically that of the 2 promising suppliers, CalFo is very strong in Uruguay, mm-hmm. and Venezuela, mm-hmm. and Colombia, mm-hmm. and then Ventura is strong in Brazil and Paraguay.
Okay. Well, that gives me an idea. You haven't found any distributor from the list you just gave me who is strong in Chile. Now, at least, Presando is strong in Chile. What would you think of the possibility, just the idea, of a limited distribution agreement that would give Presando Chile and maybe 1 or 2 other countries where you don't have something as the framework for a resolution?
Well, Presando would be our leading candidate in Chile, but they haven't demonstrated they can penetrate any markets outside of Chile. Do you have any information that's different?
Okay. At this moment, what I'd like to do is, if this is a possibility, let me talk to Presando and see what they think about it.
Okay? The mediator told Presando of Hi-Tech's interest in a limited distribution concept. He decided, however, not to disclose Hitech's preference to limit the deal to Chile. Delighted, Prasando reaffirmed interest in Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. Prasando insisted, however, on having the right to distribute all Hitech computer models, both existing and newly developed.
Prasando is willing to settle on the basis of a limited area distribution deal and has proposed Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. What do you think?
No, not all three. Brazil is definitely out of the question. Ventura is very strong there, and I'm going to want to go with them. Chile would be all right. It's probably Prasando's strength. Now, Argentina, I would still need some assurances that they're going to be able to penetrate that market.
Okay, but if they can come up with such assurances, they can have distributorships in Chile and Argentina, right?
Yes, I would agree.
Okay, now, what about the money? Can you go up from 400,000, at least so that they will have the capital to make this distributorship deal work?
And insisted that any deal include $1 million in orders by January 31st of each year.
I think we have the outlines of the deal. Hitech will give you distributorships in Chile and Argentina under two conditions. First, if you can provide solid assurances of your ability to distribute in Argentina. What can I tell them?
You can tell them we have 7 firm distributors ready to join us in Argentina.
Okay. Second, you must commit to purchase $1 million worth of Hitech products each year by January 1st.
Oh, we can do that. But what about the money?
There's still a $400,000.
Well, then we really have an open issue because we want $3 million in actual damages.
Let me ask you this. In order to get a good and profitable deal to distribute Hitech products, which is what you want, how low can you go on damages?
I don't think we can answer that today. I think we need some time to think about it. I think we're going to have to make some calculations.
Okay, that's fair. Let me suggest this. It's late. Could you have some time to talk and us pick up tomorrow?
Well, we'll need some time to talk. We can't do it in the morning. We can do it in the afternoon.
Okay, mediation soap
opera.
Well, we've reviewed our figures very, very carefully, and we think we can reduce our demand for actual damages to $1.25 million. But that's provided we can resume operations promptly.
Well, Prasando is okay on a distribution deal limited to Chile and Argentina. They have authorized me to tell you that they have 7 solid distributorships in Argentina. They will commit to $1 million in annual purchases, but they want the right to all new products and not just modifications.
Well, that part sounds all right. And we would give them the new products if they can get sales moving again.
And they've accepted our $400,000?
No. They say that they need $1.25 million to cover actual losses that they can't mitigate.
No, absolutely not. We're not paying anything close to $1 million. We had the right to terminate that contract. Don't they understand they're going to be before a judge and jury in a state where we're a major employer?
Everything but the money. And the money, they are still at $400,000.
That's outrageous. We've come down from $10 million to $1.25 million in good faith negotiations. It's time for them to move. Why won't they move?
Well, basically, they think they terminated properly and they shouldn't have to pay anything.
Steve, let me make a suggestion. We have carefully looked at this termination waiver issue, and under California law, we think we're correct. You're an expert on contracts. What would happen if you were to do your own assessment of this issue, provide it to them on a confidential basis, and tell them how you think the court would come out? We think that that would help to move them and to close the gap here.
Well, I would do that, Rich, but only under two conditions. First, they'd have to agree. Secondly, you understand it would be based upon my own independent research, and you'd have to accept that the chips will fall where they may.
Absolutely.
Giving a non-binding opinion on legal issues or a likely court outcome is not the norm in mediation practice. However, if the parties have confidence in the mediator's judgment or his expertise in the subject matter of the dispute, they may agree to such an opinion to break an impasse. Mediators are often reluctant to offer such opinions until more traditional mediation techniques have been fully employed.
Bob, have you given any further thought to increasing your offer?
No, Steve. Honestly, I don't mean to be adamant about this, but we're at our limit.
Okay. Let me make a suggestion. What would you think of my giving you and for Sandy, a non-binding opinion or prediction, if you will, of how a California court would be likely to rule on this contract termination and waiver issue? I would do it based on my independent research in the hope that it would cause somebody to rethink a little bit their position and maybe break this impasse. Bob, what do you think?
Sure, I'd like that. I mean, I've been trying to explain to Irene that we really got an advantage here and we should make the best of it. She's a little bit cautious, and I really appreciate your opinion.
Irene?
It's fine with me as long as it's non-binding. In private caucus, the mediator informed Passando that his assessment favored them. Elated, Passando was tempted to increase its money demand until the mediator pointed out that such a demand could jeopardize the emerging deal.
The facts of this case, particularly Hitech's failure to object to Presando's inaction on reorders, indicates to me that you are going to have a good deal of trouble defeating Presando's waiver argument. And if you do lose on that issue, you're looking at up to $3 million in actual damages, plus some reasonable recoupment by Presando of its investment. I suspect that after hearing this, you are going to want to consult, and you're probably going to want to talk, Bob, to some other people in your organization. Let me leave you alone for a bit, and then we'll get back together and talk soon.
Well, your opinion is certainly not what I'd expected, but Irene assures me that it's as good an evaluation as we're going to get in the case. So what I did, I took your opinion and I discussed it with our president. He'd like to get this matter behind us, and he's authorized me to go to $1.5 million. But I don't want to pay $1.5 million, so you can go back to them with $1 million.
Okay, let's see if I can feel better. Well, in light of my evaluation, Hitech has come up to $1 million. Is that enough to do the deal?
No, we're sticking at 1.25 million. That's a fair number.
Okay, I have another suggestion. Under the prior contract, Hitech retained distribution rights in your territory. Now, what impact did that have on you?
Well, we don't know whether they've actually sold computers in our area, but it's definitely hurt us. Potential distributors always ask us if we have exclusive rights. They obviously don't want us to devote time and money and effort if they're not going to get the sale, if somebody else is going to come in and get the sale. So they're leery about joining the group if we don't have exclusive rights. It's definitely hurt us on recruiting distributors.
Okay. If I could convince Hitech to give up its distributorship rights in Chile and Argentina, could I get you to come down to $1 million?
Well, I'm reluctant to come down anymore. But if you come back to us with a firm commitment that we have exclusive distributor rights in Argentina and Chile, then we'll accept $1 million.
Okay, let me try. Bob, let me explore something. Do I recall correctly that you told me that your retention of distribution rights had turned out to be just about worthless?
Yes, I did, Steve, but that was strictly
okay. So would you be willing to give up that right to get Presando to come down from $1.25 million to $1 million and close the deal?
Yes, I would do the deal for $1 million, but you can't tell them why we gave up the distribution rights.
That's great. We've got a deal. Let's get into joint session and tie it down.
In a classic example of effective mediation technique, the mediator used information given to him in confidence to overcome the last barrier to settlement. Hitech viewed its retained distribution rights as worthless. Presando saw those rights as impediments to its business. Without revealing what he learned in confidence, the mediator forged a valuable trade-off for both parties based on differing values each party placed on those rights.
I want to thank each of you for your efforts today. Every one of you worked hard, were reasonable, and the result is Let me just go over it briefly so we all hear it together. HITECH will grant to Presendo exclusive distribution rights in Chile and Argentina on Century and all new models. Presendo will order $1 million in product by January 30th of each year. HITECH will not retain distribution rights in Chile and Argentina. HITECH will pay $1 million to Presendo. Right? Okay. You've all looked at it. Let me just ask you to initial it before we leave.
As we've seen, this mediation succeeded in bringing about a mutually beneficial resolution instead of a win-lose outcome of litigation or arbitration. With skilled mediator assistance, the parties crafted an outcome based on business interests. Moreover, the mediation was faster and less expensive than litigation or arbitration. Low cost, high speed, confidentiality, and mutually satisfactory outcomes. These are the reasons that more and more businesses regard mediation as their first choice among dispute resolution processes.
I think they need a new director. Let me start by saying the first time I ever showed this film in class, one of the women students, as soon as she heard the female attorney speak, she screamed. I thought something horrible had happened. I said, "Lauren, what's wrong? What's wrong?" "It's Aunt Irene." The attorney was her aunt.
So crazy.
Isn't that great? Now, I think that you probably all noticed that very near to the end of this mediation, something happened or was said that reminded me, and I hope you, of our exercise last week in the St. Francis Hospital managed care model. Steve?
Are you asking for the specific thing that was remembered?
Yeah, at the end, I am, if you know.
No, I'm not
okay.
Sure what you're
saying. Anybody have a sense of what I'm getting at when I say that? At the near the end, one of the statements that was made to tie up the last open issue was the acknowledgement by Presendo that retaining distributor rights in, I think it was Argentina, it doesn't matter, was essentially worthless to them. And yet, as part of the mediation, that worthless right was bargained away or traded off for something else. Isn't that the essence of what we did last week in our managed medical care exercise? Isn't that what McNamara had to do? Isn't that what Mason had to do? And indeed, all of the parties, is to essentially prioritize, value their interests, prioritize them, and therefore be in that position. So it cost Presendo nothing to give that up. And yet that was instrumental in concluding the deal because it had value to the party who wanted it, but cost little or nothing to the party who gave it away. All right, and that's what I meant. Yes, Paula.
Well, I also thought you were going for comparison of last week. It was, if we don't figure this out, it's gonna go to the board and they're gonna figure it out. And here it was, what do you think that the courts are gonna decide?
Absolutely, that's another. I mean, there are probably many things that we could say about the dovetailing of this particular exercise and what happened last week. And I'd be happy to entertain any other comments of that kind that any of you may have. If you please feel free to speak.
I have a question. So towards the entire time, the mediator seemed to be very impartial. And then at the end, I'm not good with names of companies, not Presendo,
that's okay.
The other one,
right.
Said that we'll go up to $1.5 million.
Right.
And then he came back to Presendo and said, we'll go to $1 million, whereas they were asking for $1.25.
Right.
So at that point, couldn't he have just gone back and said, okay, they'll give you the 1.25? So it seems like he was picking the side then of the computer company.
He didn't do that of his own volition. He was asked by that disputing party
to present it in that way.
To present 1 million.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, that does, some mediators get queasy about that.
Yeah.
Because, after all, if we're being candid, there is something a little dishonest about it. And yet, there is such a dominant concern that in caucuses with parties to a dispute, that the mediator, in fact, retained the confidence that's shared in them in that caucus by that party, that most mediators are pretty reluctant to just say, well, you know, I really can't do that, because if I know that you're willing to pay 1.25, I don't feel comfortable going in and offering them a million. You know, it's one of those sort of soft, ethical mediator questions that people come down on different sides of. Richard.
But it seemed like, because he said make an offer of a million more as a face-saving gesture, since they had given up a number of other items, and that therefore, as a mediator, wouldn't you respect that and offer that chance to save face?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it, and I think that the mediator undoubtedly saw that as one of his roles. Now, I think that you're all able to notice the very direct shift in this particular case from the mediator operating to facilitate the resolution of this dispute, and then coming to a point where, in effect, what he did, subject to certain conditions that he explicitly imposed, was to shift from a mediator role to essentially an arbitrator role, and to give a non-binding opinion of an arbitrator. And it's important for me to have you see this, because it's necessary to understand that in the mediation community, the dialogue and debate over facilitative versus evaluative mediation is ongoing and will never, ever be resolved. I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it clearly shows that there is something here that is very difficult to get total agreement on, even from extremely experienced mediators and even scholars and commentators on the subject. So let me put it in this way. The purest of mediation models is the wholly facilitative one, in which, in effect, the mediator does not profess to be rendering opinions, even by way of recommendation, to the parties on substantive issues. All right? Now, that's fine, except realistically, in the context of mediations in the shadow of a court setting, you run into the problem of having a difficult time as mediators being able to achieve the pure ideal, given the fact that the parties are actually conducting this mediation knowing full well that there are, in fact, external or extrinsic norms that are in the hands of the institution, the court, in the event that the mediation is unsuccessful. And consequently, the mediator in those situations is often relying a great deal on the fact that the parties are typically represented, as here, by what we hope are competent counsel, who are advising them about the risks inherent with being able to make good a certain proposition that is their stance in the litigation, and telling them candidly, we hope, what the risks and benefits are, risks and costs of being able to sustain a particular position. Now, when this guy says, I will do independent research and render an independent and non-binding opinion on the contract question and how the California courts will handle it, he's doing something that a lot of mediators would not do. in part because the underlying presumption is that as a mediator, I am privy to, in effect, confidential information that inevitably can't be eliminated from my ken and my view of the larger situation, and could at least in theory impact on me in my determination of the issue that I'm being asked to render the non-binding or binding opinion on. Now that's the argument. Having said that, I will tell you I do it all the time. I do. And in fact, the longer that I mediate and the more experience that I have, the more I find that these parties, mostly already in litigation, develop a rapport with me and a trust that makes them effectively inclined to think that they will get a more responsive and, in fact, unbiased opinion from me in a shorter amount of time and with maybe, sadly, and I'm not talking on behalf of myself, I'm talking the perspective of the litigants and their attorneys, that they may opt to say, do I want to give this open question when we've resolved all the other matters to the court for a determination, when in a much more efficient, economical way, we can present that same situation to a person who probably knows the case more intimately than even the court, and get a response that we're willing to honor. When they do that, and you'll see that Goldberg insisted that it be the judgment of both parties and their counsel that they wanted such an opinion, and they understood that the opinion could come down in a way that was negative to them, understand that the problem is heightened exponentially if you were to do something like that before the very end of the mediation, in which all issues but that single open issue had been resolved. Because clearly, if he had rendered that non-binding opinion in the middle of the mediation, it is quite possible that that would have affected his perceived impartiality. And so when people, mediators, are willing to take that role and shift to a quasi-arbitration role, very often they're careful, as am I, to do it at a point in which I don't think that I would be sacrificing my perceived neutrality. Okay, yes?
Is it also toward the end of, it's not just your impartiality, but is it towards the end of where you think they're coming together and you don't want to break it up? You don't want to break apart the negotiation? Like, if you see as a negotiator that it's coming together.
Right.
I'm just thinking it's not only your impartiality. I mean, that's a great thing, but I mean, it looked like they were getting closer and closer, and I just feel like if he brought that up sooner, that would have cracked it apart. Like, do you bring it?
Well, you, first of all, you don't bring it up.
No, well, they, okay.
Under any circumstances. Right. If the parties are seeking that, because they believe that they will not be able to reach a meeting of the minds on that or some other question that is not yet solved in the mediation, but that could lead to a global resolution. It's at that point that you have to entertain this difficult decision as to whether to accept the alternative role. But I think you're putting your fingers on the most important point, but not quite saying it, and that is, you see, they wouldn't have asked him for that if they didn't believe that the opinion he would give would be as good an opinion or better than they would end up having to entertain from the court. And so from their point of view, that by expressing that comfort level in his independent research and abilities, they were in effect ceding the authority to him, and you notice that even though it's non-binding, it's going to have, in most cases,
a very persuasive impact because of the fact they wouldn't ask for the opinion if they didn't believe that it had should be given some credence. Okay? Now, sometimes as well in mediation, when these kinds of situations develop, you can use alternatives to non-binding opinion. You can actually say either, do you accept this as a binding resolution of that particular open issue? Or there's a middle ground. Will you accept it not as binding, but as evidentiary in the case? The difference being that if it is evidentiary but not binding, the litigants, and in particular their attorneys, will know that the likelihood of having that opinion, which is a neutral opinion, not an expert opinion of a hired, you know, for a hired hand for one side, is likely to be given a lot of weight by the ultimate trier of fact. And so you have a high likelihood, even though it's not a binding opinion, of that ending up being the ultimate resolution on that remaining open issue. Richard.
I'm curious, there was a lot of confidential information exchange in these caucuses. What happens, or what is the mediator's obligation, because he's supposed to be unbiased and committed, if he finds something in this confidential information that is not available to the other side, and but would seriously compromise, I mean, I guess, suppose that you're negotiating a divorce, and you've got property and child custody issues, and you suddenly, in the process of the caucus, you find out one spouse has several $1 million stashed away that the spouse is not aware of.
Great question, which I was hoping you'd ask. And he's not a straight man. I didn't set him up. Let me start by asking a question back to you. To whom is the mediator accountable? Who are you accountable to?
I think really just to yourself. Yeah.
To yourself, you say. Yes,
and
Elizabeth.
And the agreements of the terms of whatever mediation between the two parties, the agreements of what your role is.
I didn't hear. Say it again.
Oh, sorry. When you start the mediation, you define what your role is with the party. So
okay.
Your adherence to whatever you defined your role as being.
That's an interesting perspective and certainly relevant, but I'm not sure that it covers the whole issue of who a mediator is accountable to. Yes, and
then. I was thinking maybe to whoever the mediator is liable to, because I mean, I think the mediator should probably worry about issues of liability.
Frankly, not usually.
Okay.
There are cases, few, very few, in which mediators have been sued. But frankly, there aren't a lot of them, number one. And number two, they would usually be cases in which the mediator has done something that's pretty flagrant, such as violate a confidence or something along those lines. But ordinarily, and mediators, by the way, are also usually insured, as are attorneys and physicians. So while I'm not saying that might not be relevant in any given case, that's not usually a highly motivating factor. Let me frame this in a different way. If I am doing my job and I'm doing it effectively, and the parties under my guidance and assistance reach their own non-coerced resolution of their dispute, is party satisfaction the sole criterion for whether the mediation has been conducted properly and effectively?
Well, I think it depends on the issue, right? When they were talking about divorce lawyers, you need to think about the unprotected parties, the children. Or if it's an environmental issue, you think about the public or community.
Very, very important point. Unrepresented parties, but you're stating it as though it's presumptive that the mediator is responsible to those unrepresented parties. Is that self-evident that she is?
I think
responsible to those those parties who are not present? Yep, Steve?
I think maybe what another way to look at it in some of the readings is that the mediator is responsible to make sure that the parties seek their own appropriate legal counsel and have, so that the parties present have all the information so that they can come to the agreement. But maybe it's becomes very much more directive if they start to do so much of this kind of like evaluative stuff like we were talking about. It's no longer mediating.
It starts not look, and you know what? There's an article, I don't think I assigned it to you, strangely enough, the title of the article is Evaluative Mediation, colon, an oxymoron, question mark. And I think it's obvious that Marjorie Corman Aaron, who wrote the article, that her view is, yes, it is oxymoronic.
I was thinking also about institutional policy. If that mediator is working in an institution, for example, a PEN, so maybe that mediator would be accountable to the policies of that institution and maybe the code of conduct governing mediation for that particular.
In the event, these are all excellent points. The fact is, Andam, that we are going to see when we begin to study clinical mediation, that is an almost a given, and therefore presents the problem in a hospital setting. If the mediator is either employed by and or paid by the hospital, will there be a perception of a lack of neutrality on the part of that mediator by the parties? One of the things we'll talk about when we study this is that, oddly enough, although we would certainly, in a legal matter, in a business matter, almost take as a given that a mediator who was being paid by or employed by one of the disputing parties would have to recuse himself as being conflicted out. Strangely enough, in clinical mediations, it's happening fairly frequently, and there are relatively few complaints or instances in which the disputing parties say, "Oh my God, I can't deal with this. This is crazy. You're just an alter ego for the hospital. Why should I mediate this dispute with you?" Well, it's interesting. At Montefiore Hospital in New York, which is really the most established and oldest mediation program in clinical ethics, Nancy Dubler, who is the leading light and now retired of that program, had an article written in the New York Times about 5 years ago in which they came in and interviewed people in connection with the program, and one of the people they interviewed was the husband of a patient, and their family had been in a successful mediation in that program. And they asked the guy what he thought, and he said, I really feel great. I mean, I really feel good about this, and it's wonderful and stuff. I'm not sure if I got brainwashed, but, and that it actually appeared that way in the New York Times, which Nancy wasn't too happy about. I can assure you, though, from my knowledge of Nancy and the way that program works, that to the extent this issue is germane, the part of it that is germane is about perception. It isn't about realistically being a toady to the reigning hospital honchos. The fact of the matter is they respect her, she respects them, they understand that part of the reason she's there is to bring that neutrality to the table, because it's only if in fact she is conveying an effective impartial presence that the hospital receives the benefits of what she's being there, meaning greater patient satisfaction, higher press gainy ratings and so on and so forth. I hate to reduce it to such a practical consideration, but it really is true. Nobody tried to ever pressure Nancy Dubler in any way to come up with an outcome that was consistent with hospital policy. Richard.
I just, to go back to my original question, though, what I'm still not clear on is it seems that in the sense where you have knowledge that clearly creates the appearance of unfairness,
yes,
that if the mediation is going well and you're facilitating it and you reach an amicable solution, that you have essentially achieved your purpose. However, on the other hand, by facilitating that discussion,
yep,
I think it's analogous to an attorney putting a patient or putting a client on the stand who he knows is going to submit perjured testimony.
So do I. And but here's the answer.
Okay.
The answer is that you as a mediator do not give up your own ethical standards. You don't give up your moral commitments. And if, in fact, you are engaged in a mediation process in which you think there is that kind of overreaching and dishonesty to a point at which it really will potentially impact the outcome of the process, you have the following alternatives available to you. One is to step back and recuse yourself and simply indicate to that party that, as far as you're concerned, the mediation ends here if, in fact, they continue to insist that you, in effect, become a shill for them in lying about the facts. Because to go back to what Stephen was saying before, there is, in fact, a notion, and this is a somewhat separate from the question of facilitative versus evaluative, and it certainly is, I would say, the template that I use in my own practice, is more of an informed consent model. In other words, you can argue about who we are accountable to and include in that argument your point about not only unrepresented parties, but society at large. So when we get into mediation in the context of environmental disputes, somebody like Larry Susskind will argue, and has argued in print, that in fact a mediator in an environmental mediation does have a responsibility both to the unpresent parties and to society as a whole, when in fact the outcomes of this mediation may have an impact on something as dramatic as your grandchildren's ability to breathe the air and drink the water that is in our environment. So in environmental mediation is where this has come out in such a strongly argued way. Yes?
But I think also our earlier readings about personal relationships and
yep,
networking, I think that's what it comes down to on an individual level. Like what happens when you facilitate an agreement that crumbles right after? So I think that's...
That's an excellent point. Certainly if, I'm going to just restate what you said, I think what Catherine is saying is, in the event that you were to hang in there and come to a consensual resolution that was founded on dishonesty, and one of the parties to that consensual resolution found out later and attempted to either collaterally attack it formally by going to court and saying this was not in fact an agreement that I reached in an uncoerced voluntary way, but rather something that I was manipulated into doing by being given false information, that might actually be sustainable. But what she's saying is you don't even have to go that far. What happens, even if the party doesn't seek redress from the courts, but finds out that they were manipulated? Number one, it not only changes that party's perception of the quality of the mediation, it also challenges that party's perception of the quality and effectiveness of the mediator. You are not going to have a mediation practice very long if you end up being a party who has essentially broker resolutions that result in that kind of response to its outcome. Victoria.
I'm curious, what's the percentage?
percentage of mediators that are lawyers?
Say that again?
What percentage of mediators are lawyers?
Nowadays, most mediators are lawyers, but they are not all lawyers, and it also depends on the field in which they practice. So that in matrimonial cases, for example, it's not unusual to have accountants being involved in the what are called the collateral issues of the equitable distribution of property, or the payment of support or alimony, and they can be experienced in that field and contribute greatly to the process. In New Jersey, where I mostly practice, for example, the New Jersey Association of Professional Mediators, I would say has about 75% to 80% attorneys, and the balance are psychologists, social workers, accountants, and people of, you know, a few other what I'll call related professions. So it is not mandatory that everybody who is a mediator has a law degree, but if in fact you are trying to establish a mediation practice in matters that deal with business and legal disputes, it is probably more likely that you're going to be able to do that with a law degree, in fact, so, as a practical matter.
So I was going to, that was my intuition, so I was going to mention that you were asking about the duty. What duty does the mediator have?
Yep.
To whom is he accountable? Well, in that case, if he's a lawyer, then there are professional responsibility roles that he needs to abide by. But I wanted to ask, is there any sort of actual legal duty of care on that mediator? An arbitrator has some kind of duty to the court system, right?
Well, the only in the sense that an arbitrary and capricious implementation of that arbitrator's duties would be subject to appeal. But the duty that I'm describing or talking about is more at the level not of institutional responsibility, but it speaks to the question of what it is that makes an effective mediator be able to rise to the level of not just being workmanlike, but being somebody who can be perceived by the public as well as his or her peers as being somebody who strikes that balance that is very difficult to strike in practicing this profession. And I'll get to you in a second. Well, I just want to make sure that everybody understands why this premise that, yes, you are responsible for the quality of the outcomes is problematic and is still argued with regularly. And I hope it's obvious to you, which is, I'm a mediator. I have an opinion. Who died and made me God? How do I know that my opinion, or how do you know that my opinion should be taken as gospel just because I feel strongly X, or I feel strongly Y? So I want to go back to this informed consent model. If I am a mediator that is involved in helping the parties resolve a dispute, what I want to know is, do you understand and are you privy to all of the information that is relevant to you about how you're going to engage in decision making with regard to that dispute? I'm going to want to know whether you are personally satisfied that what you have elected to do is in compliance with the law. I want to know whether what you have elected to do creates a comfort level in you regarding its ethical components. I want to be sure that you are not reaching a consensual resolution that you are reaching because of coercion that was placed upon you, not only by people within the mediation process, but external to the mediation process. Don't think that it isn't common for people come to the table in a mediation who are being whispered at by relatives, friends, etc., who have a fair amount of persuasive power over those people, and then in the context of the mediation, rather than fully participating in an open way, contributing, hearing, listening, they are really being conduits for a third party perspective, all of those kinds of things. So at the end of the day, I look at it as analogous to what a physician's duty is before the physician engages in a treatment, meaning I'm not going to feel comfortable blessing a resolution in which in which all parties don't evidence to me what stands by my criteria as informed consent. And again, I have to, and this is very important to you guys as prospective healthcare mediators, remember, we're just now getting a mindset. We haven't even started to talk about what you have to do in your area. You're not going to have the luxury in 99% of the cases that you confront. These people aren't having lawyers at the table. We're not talking about, in this class, we are not talking about mediating medical malpractice litigation. We're talking about upstream encounters in the clinic. And you're lucky if you have a chair, let alone a lawyer. You're lucky if you have a light, and you're lucky if you can get the damn surgeon to come down in time to have the mediation. So we're talking about a totally different ballgame in that respect. But imagine how much more of a burden there is going to be on you to be able to make that conclusion about your comfort level with them having what you deem to be informed consent when there's nobody there counseling them. And, you know, in other words, a mediator in a legal case with parties who are not pro se are unrepresented parties, has the right and the ability to rely on the fact that counsel is advising their respective clients. And you can also engage in a dialogue with those attorneys that takes the form of such things as, and this is not directive, it's querulous, are you aware of the line of cases on X topic? What do you think about the impact of Smith versus Jones on the outcome in this case? And so on. And there, you're not being evaluative. You're not saying, I think you should come down in your demand because the way I read Smith versus Jones suggests that your demand is absurd, right? There's a very great difference between making a statement like that versus asking the question, have you considered? Or what do you think of, right? And Bridge.
Just a quick question on how you phrase something. The mediator in this said frequently, have you ever considered?
Yep.
That to me, every once in a while when he said that, kind of...
Too much edge.
That may have rubbed me the wrong way. Because right. It makes you sound like if you're asking me that, it's like, well, have you ever, possibly ever thought of this? Which
It's tonal. Like it. It's tonal, isn't it?
The connotation is that, you know... I haven't considered it.
Which means you must be an idiot.
Yeah, and it's something like it's an oversight on my part.
Right.
So would you endorse that line of phrasing?
I don't think it's so much the words as how the words are communicated.
Okay.
And, you know, I in fact want to go back, even as we speak, to our discussion the first day in class about communication and information in negotiation. And remember that as mediators, just as negotiators, if you were performing on your own behalf, not as a neutral assisting. Remember what we learned about questions and probing. Remember how what we learned about the use of open-ended questions and the use of closed ends or focused narrow questions. Mediators have a very great need to be able to be skilled at posing both kinds of questions. And you heard him say, I hope, and this was one of his better moments, was why, tell me why you entered into this contract in the first place. Meaning he wasn't asking about the dispute. He was asking about expectations that were associated with creating the relationship in the first place. Well, when you ask that, you are putting that party in the role of having to convey to you what they would like to have seen come out of the relationship, as opposed to what did come out of it, thereby enabling you as the mediator to see if you can reconstruct the relationship such that it can still deliver what the underlying interests were that propelled him into going into the relationship. The comparable component in a medical setting will be the famous question, and this is Nancy Dubler's as well, which to me is really part of the bedrock of this, which is, tell me about mama. That's the open-ended question. Tell me about mama. And why tell me about mama? I can't possibly know enough about mama to be able to frame a sequence of 400 questions that inevitably might yield what it is that's going to be helpful to me going forward. But if I give you a Rorschach test and you happen to blurt out what in fact is going to be the key to resolving the entire dispute, it's going to be because I put you in that position by asking you, tell me about mama. I'm going to learn what were mama's values? What were mama's expectations of a good life? What was mama likely to think about what a dignified death would be? And so on and so forth. But then when you ask a narrow, focused question, as we discussed on day one of the negotiation lecture, what you're going to find out is one of two things. I ask the question, Amy can't answer it, I can only surmise one of two things. She doesn't know much, or she's lying. And then we have to pursue either of those two avenues. So you've got to be doing two things at once, exploring the open-ended question, but pursuing the sequence of questions that's designed to reveal candor, knowledge, and so forth. Okay, but let's still go back a little bit more to this issue of the mediator's larger role. As I indicated, Catherine, to you, this problem of mediators engaging in evaluative behavior is subject to this problem of who am I to say what is right or what people should do.
And
go ahead.
I thought that was really interesting to have gone through that evaluation and then in the end not get the best price for Progenda or whatever from Hi-Tech to bring them down to the $1 million instead of fighting for the 1.25. I thought that was important to have gone through that evaluation and then still to remain impartial after that evaluation.
And you think that impartiality would have demanded that you articulate that the 1.25 million is more likely to comport with the legal norms?
To me, it was almost lucky that there was that last piece to negotiate to give them the exclusive distributorship.
Right.
I think if it wasn't there, I would have felt more conflicted about that.
Interesting. What do other people think about that? Yes, sorry, Katie.
Well, I think the other company could have done the same thing that the first company did and say, we want 3
we'll go to 1.25, but please don't tell them that. And then he would have had more conflicts, right, if he was bound by confidentiality on both parties, whereas in the video it was just one party who asked him to keep it a secret. So
anyone?
It seems like the company that did ask for him to keep it confidential just was more strategic or better at.
But it also, it went down to an individual level, like knowing that the CEO was willing to pay 1.5, it was strange to me for the mediator to respect the individual person at the table rather than know that the company had interests that were compatible with.
The company meaning
like
his
high
company.
Tech, yeah, high tech.
Was, yeah.
Because high tech would have been okay with paying a little bit less. That would at 1.25, and then Presendo would have been happy because it would have reached their goals. So it did seem a little bit like
I indicated he was so squeezy.
Quickly was like, yeah. Oh yeah, sure, we'll go for 1 million.
I don't think that's a slam dunk
yeah.
as to whether the mediator should have behaved in that way. But yes, Amy.
I still feel like all the mediator was asked to do and given permission to do was give an opinion about mm-hmm. what the court would have found about this contract. And it's still like totally valid in a negotiation to offer less than you're willing to give.
I think that's the counter argument. I think the flaw in your argument is that you're assuming that the decision that he made and then gave as an advisory opinion is absolutely synonymous
yeah.
with the fact that 1.25 million would be a reasonable number.
Yeah.
And as Amy says, really, we don't have any idea yet, just from his determination about contract law, what the proper damages number would be.
I think what really strikes me is just when it came down to it, who is the mediator more accountable to, the person at the table who's representing the company or the company itself, like the CEO?
I think that that question is not, I understand why you're articulating it that way. But remember, that guy at the table is the company for purposes of that negotiation because he's been given authority. And I think, from my perspective, the mediator is not going to go behind the person who has authority and try, but it raises an extremely interesting question because there are times in mediation when in fact the party at the table has a constituency, and that constituency may or may not have the power to ratify or approve what it is that the party at the table is negotiating. But in those situations, it's the obligation of the negotiator to make clear that he or she is not making these statements with full authority and requires ratification. So I think that really, at least for me, isn't a significant issue. Yeah, Dave.
My issue, I guess, with that final part of the negotiation there wasn't so much that he came back with the 1 million and came up with that solution. It was kind of that he didn't flush out with Presendo whether the extra $250,000 was more important to them or this other concession.
The exclusive.
Yeah, the exclusive. So, you know, because he could have said, you know, there are possibilities here and I could come back and really insist on the 1.25 and maybe they would budge. I think that's honest in his head without giving away their hand that they could go to 1.5.
Got it.
Say, or there is this other option that may be a possibility. Which one would be more important to you? And if the answer was the other concession, then great, that's awesome. But if the answer was the money, then you come back and say, hey, you know, they're really standing firm at 1.25. You told me you've been authorized to go to 1.5. This seems like, so he didn't quite, I don't think, flush
sounds,
it out to the
right,
end.
It sounds like what you're thinking is that he engaged in unnecessary shortcuts
mm-hmm.
yeah.
that might have moved the process forward, but not have made the process as complete and as effective as a process
mm-hmm.
as it might have been, regardless of whether it ended with the same outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And the option was there to do it.
Yes, it was.
And I think it was reasonable. It wasn't like he was really reaching to do that.
I think that David's point is not only well taken, but brings us back to what we discussed when we were talking about the subject of interests in negotiation and the lax and Sabinius categories of interest. Because here, in this mediation, just as in independent negotiations, all of the parties have some degree or other of interest in the quality of the process. And as we know, individuals differ in the extent to which they place value on that. But in fact, if I were an individual who placed enormous value on the quality of the process and saw this as less than the best, it might have led me to have doubts about the resolution that could have impacted the outcome. And therefore, just as in an independent, unassisted negotiation, one wants to be aware of such things as intrinsic, instrumental, substantive, process, principle, and relationship values while you're managing this process. Again, it isn't an easy job to do. Yeah, Paula.
I think when this this mediator did that, and you say you do it, I actually think that you're doing a service. You're giving a good service because here you are, you're an expert. You've been doing it for 30 years. You're not just someone who's giving your personal opinion. You're giving your opinion based on 30 years of experience.
Well, wait. I appreciate that, and I love you dearly, but let's make sure we understand. But expert in what? When I come to
what he's doing,
no. But wait, let's clarify. I'm not saying that he isn't, and in fact he was an agreed upon expert in the subject matter.
Right.
But as a mediator, when I am doing my job, I'm an expert, as far as I'm concerned, in only one thing, dispute resolution. Now, if the parties make an inquiry as to whether I have subject matter expertise in an issue that's in the mediation, in the substantive issues in the mediation, I will, of course, tell them the truth, yay or nay. But it can't be presumed, because I have been mediating for the number of years that I've been mediating, that I have any reasonable level of expertise in a particular subject matter question. Yes?
I don't know if this was sort of a factor of the reenactment or not, but the mediator seemed to me to be getting increasingly exasperated.
He did seem to be exasperated?
Yeah.
Okay.
At the end of the first day, the fact that they hadn't come to a resolution sort of seemed to bother him. And then the next day, he's just like, okay, come on. Yeah, come on. And it was just, I was wondering how it can sort of have a huge impact on the parties.
Huge.
To feel rushed.
Huge. So. I would have to say that at bottom, one of the most important characteristics of an effective mediator is, I'll use multiple words rather than one, but you have to be tireless, you have to be unyieldingly optimistic, and you have to be ready to persist in the face of all kinds of negative events. You will remember that early in this mediation, one of the parties said, that's it. This is going nowhere, right? That happens in every mediation. This is not, sui generis. This is not one of a kind. Every mediation. And in fact, although I think it's an exaggeration, it's not too far from the truth that before most mediations resolve, they crater first. Mediators who are effective look at those falling apart moments as opportunities. They don't get, Shauna, what you said Eric got, and I don't know why he did that. In this case, he's a pretty experienced guy, but there's no doubt. I mean, one of the things that I find after so many years, people saying to me is, how can you be so calm and unperturbable. I don't, you know, I would shoot my, you know, that's, I get that kind of feedback all the time. And I don't feel as though I'm the world's most patient human being or that I have any, but apparently I do in the eyes of the people who I'm assisting. Yes, Jesse.
I was going to say, as soon as you started saying tireless, unyieldingly optimistic, and persistent in the face of tons of things, I sort of thought of parenting. Because actually, it's exactly, I'm not a parent actually at all, but no. but it's exactly the same.